are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Welcome to Dragon Root, feminist-powered radio brought to you by CKUT and the 2110 Center for Gender Advocacy. The Dragon Root symbolizes the diversity of every body and mind on the gender spectrum. Tune in every Tuesday morning from 8:30 to 9 on 90.3 FM or CKUT.ca/listen. You can also pick and choose from our archives at center2110.org. We bring you reports from the Dragon Root Radio Project on gendered violence, live tunes from feminist, queer, trans, and gender-aware musical guests, and interviews about a wide array of social justice issues examined through a gender-perceptive lens. First, we hear clips from a workshop at the 2110 Center in February on gender and environmental racism. Maya of Missing Justice speaks about environment, race, and gender, where they meet, where they converge, and how they never should have been thought about separately. Do stay tuned. This is CKUT 90.3 FM.
The first little anecdote I wanted to share, I thought was a good illustration of just the type of dynamic, the type of lack of, I don't even like saying lack of analysis or lack of intersectionality, because it's, those words are both really annoying to me. And really, like, not everyone understands what they mean and so on, but I guess because I'm standing up here talking about environment, race, and gender, we are talking about where they meet, where they converge, and how they should never have been thought about separately at all to begin with. So there's this little anecdote. Has anyone seen the documentary Pickaxe? This is where these images are from. Okay, so thought it would just be better to sum up a little bit one of the things that happens or that gets depicted in this documentary rather than show you a clip, because there's no one clip that would really do it. But basically, this story is meant to look at our own, for those of us that are involved in activist or social justice groups or circles, to look at our own, the power dynamics that happen in our own involvements. So this documentary is about, like, in the 1990s in Oregon, and about this group of activists that were fighting against clear-cutting that was happening. They really managed to drum up a lot of support, got a lot of international attention. Cascadia, there was a lot of chaining bodies to trees and a lot of media attention and a lot of just, it was a high-profile thing. It went on for months and months, and they managed to delay the cutting for a long time. But basically, one of the things that I thought was really interesting that gets depicted in this documentary is just the dynamic between the men and women in the group. You had a situation where, and I don't think this is an isolated situation, from my own experiences, I know it's not, my own conversations, where a lot of the actual, like locking down and like getting arrested and doing a lot of the menial work was done by women, and a lot of the talking to media, being on camera, doing interviews was done by men. I mean, that's, you know, maybe that's all fine and dandy if that's the way everyone in the group wants it. You know, I mean, it's one thing to say we all are doing what we want to be doing anyway, and it's another thing to tokenize someone and tell them to do something they don't want to do just because they're a woman. And I've experienced that as well. But in this documentary, there was at least 15 minutes devoted to the fact that the women were not happy with the situation, that there was a lot of bitterness going on between members of the group as a result of this gender divide. A lot of the men in the group who were interviewed about it, the response was along the lines of, well, clearly it's important. Clearly these deep-seated gender dynamic issues among our group are really important. However, we need to deal with the urgent matters first. The urgent matters such as saving the forest and getting the word out, and that's more urgent. And once that's dealt with, once we save the trees, then we can deal with the more deep-seated issues after that. Because clearly there's like a hierarchy of priority here. They didn't use those words, those are my words. I'm just pointing to this as an example of sort of problematic that exists everywhere we turn, because in a way everything's always urgent. I would liken this to certain environmental NGOs in Canada even, who are going ahead with trying to strike deals often with government and logging companies because it's urgent, without consulting First Nations, because it's urgent, the types of dynamics that creates. So whether we're talking about not dealing with gender issues as they come up, not dealing with First Nations issues, nation-to-nation issues as they come up, no matter what it is, if we're not dealing with every human as they're involved and like excluding a certain group of people and not consulting them, then we're just going to replicate the same really terrible capitalist patriarchal power dynamics that we're supposed to be trying to, that supposedly created these problems to begin with, right? So, and then we end up having to start all over again, or maybe we don't have time to do that, I don't know. So that's just one story. And here in Canada, as I just mentioned, there's also been a lot of drama in the last few years around something called the Canadian Boreal Initiative. Organizations such as Greenpeace going ahead without consulting First Nations, and lots of battles going on there. Same type of dynamic.
This is Dragon Root Radio during the Tuesday morning after CKUT. In the next clip from the Gender and Environmental Racism workshop organized by CKUT and the 2110 in February, Maya of Missing Justice addresses reproductive justice and population growth. Do stay tuned.
That's our Prime Minister Havren and International Cooperation Minister Bev Oda at the time. And I don't know if any of you remember back in 2010 when the G20 summits happened and Harper's so-called maternal health initiative for other countries was unveiled. The segue is, okay, the same dynamics exist on the governmental level. Which one's worse? I don't know. I think they're both pretty bad. On this level, you had Bev Oda at the time sort of being quoted as saying, basically there was, Harper was championing maternal health at the time and saying, and we really care about the health of mothers and children across the globe. But at the same time as he was saying this, he was sort of recreating almost identical to George W. Bush's model for the 8 years he was in office, where his foreign aid policy sort of banned support for aid organizations that were supporting abortion in so-called developing countries. So Harper announced during these summits in 2010, or his government announced, that contraception would not be included in these packages. And then Bev Oda was quoted as saying, when we know what we can do by providing clean water, vaccinations, better nutrition, blah, 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 then maybe we'll deal with, this. So again, it's a similar thing as was happening in the Pickaxe documentary, where we're saying, okay, these things are more urgent. Clearly the power differences are much more pronounced in this particular example. And then people were pointing to this type of foreign policy, this, like, disastrously racist and sexist foreign policy as being the government's way, our current government's way of also creating an environment domestically within the country where maybe the debate can be reopened here too. Maybe it's not so unfathomable. And then you have, throughout the last couple of years since then, all sorts of attempts to reopen the abortion debate here in the country as well, as I'm sure a lot of you have heard of. 312, just a few months ago, our very own Status of Women Minister Rona Ambrose votes to reopen the debate. Luckily, it got shut down anyway, but her argumentation for it was that she feared that people would seek out abortions based on sex discrimination. So as to say that her concern was that people would abort their... abort because they knew they were having girls. And first of all, I've never heard of that being an issue here, but if it was, that would definitely not, the solution would definitely not be, in my personal opinion, to curb the reproductive freedoms of women living in the country. So I bring this up because of what I like to call the politics of population growth. And population growth, I mean, I think awareness is growing around this not really being the case and not being true in recent years, but population growth has been blamed for everything across the world, from deforestation to civil wars to lack of resources and so on. I just don't think anything could be less true. And this way of thinking and this way of pointing to population growth as being responsible in any way for these problems not only points the finger and places blame on women, but women in majority world countries. The same women whose access to contraception and abortion is being cut off by our own government. So you have a double-edged thing here where not only you have a situation where women, and I will say the women with the least access to, I don't know, money and certain types of choices in the majority of the world are being simultaneously blamed, maybe not directly, but between the lines of our discourse, for overpopulation and using up too many resources and contributing to the world's problems in that way, and simultaneously barred from accessing the resources they might use should they choose to not have more children, for example. So it's really, really like doubly, triply problematic on a number of levels. And at the same time as all of this, as this double blame and barred access, this dynamic enables and facilitates continued land and resource theft in the very places where these women and their communities are from. And Canada is among the worst, since our entire economy is just completely based both here and abroad, both in First Nations communities here, communities in other countries, on land and resource theft, ongoing land and resource theft. So it's both really simple and really complicated at the same time. Hopefully that makes sense to people. I also wanted to bring up just really briefly that Canada has a history of other very clearly, at least in my mind and in the minds of many, politically motivated reproductive justice rights violations. So basically another one is that up until the 70s, there were eugenics boards in Canada that were forcing sterilization among communities of Native women in First Nations communities. All sorts of tests were sort of run on various groups of people, largely First Nations people. Evaluations were done on who was fit to procreate and who wasn't. And I'm being really reductive here, but it's worth looking up if you're interested in this or talking to me later. But there's been lots of politically motivated, and one could even say capital and resource acquisition motivated, attacks on women's reproductive rights.
You are listening to Dragon Root Radio here on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is part of the Tuesday Morning After. In the next clip from the Gender and Environmental Racism Workshop organized by CKUT and the 2110 in February as part of the Dragon Root Workshop series on understanding gendered violence, Maya of Missing Justice speaks about the resistance of Indigenous communities, including the community of Fort Chipewyan, to tar sands expansion. Maya also speaks about an example of environmental racism in Nova Scotia. Do stay tuned.
Well, basically, just to give you a quick rundown, Fort Chip is a community of 1,200 people. And at the time that I had gone, and I'm sure there's larger numbers now, there were 5 to 10 in process, figuring out how many. There were people coming up with this rare cancer of the bile duct, and dying, people 16 years old, 25 years old, getting all different types of cancers besides that type as well. Two-headed fish were being found. Normally this one type of rare bile duct cancer is found like 1 in 100,000 people, and we're talking about a community of 1,200 people. And there was a doctor there by the name of John McDonald, I think, who was actually a non-Native man who had committed his life to working in Fort Chipewyan, which is what the place is called. And he was threatened a number of times by the government for being an alarmist, because he was actually confirming what patients were saying. Definitely credit to him, because he kept on with it in spite of threats, and almost lost his medical practice and so on. And for a number of years, there was a refusal to do proper environmental assessments, saying that these sicknesses and these deaths even had nothing to do with the tar sands. In the end, it was discovered, because there was finally proper scientific research done. There's actually a great documentary called H2 Oil about the situation there, which would seriously kick anybody's ass, which I'd recommend watching. Finally, it was discovered that, yes, there are lethal levels of arsenic in their water and so on. And yes, in fact, these deaths and cancers are linked to the tar sands. Yet still, of course, nothing's been done. The community is actually still in the process of taking the Alberta government to court, the Supreme Court. So, but this is by no means slowed what's going on there, which is one of, if not the largest and most damaging mega project, environmental oil extraction mega project in the world. And one of the elders that I visited there at the time, who I stayed with, who my partner and I stayed with, Selena, was telling us about how there's a neighboring town, maybe about a decade ago, a largely white town, who was complaining about deadly black green gas and bad odors and coughing and so on, and their complaints were actually dealt with, and that particular plant was closed down. However, there have been protests and resistance on all levels by various First Nations communities, including Fort Chipewyan, Fort Mackay, and others, right in the path of the tar sands. And so far, nothing's been heeded, and it took years to even get proper environmental assessment. So we could draw our own conclusions, perhaps. And then I also wanted to cite as an example, has anyone heard of Lincolnville, Nova Scotia? It's a small-ish community in Nova Scotia, largely people of African descent living there. Basically, there's this whole thing. It's still going on right now. I learned a little bit about it when I was there a few years ago. But there's basically two really massive leaking landfills in their community. And basically, one of them was opened. The first one was opened in 1974. It's basically, quote, a hole in the ground with no monitoring for the first 25 years, and still leaks. Again, as with Fort Chipewyan, abnormally high rates of rare cancers, and right from the start, 1974, and again with the opening of the second one in 2006. The second one opened. Both times, massive protests, nothing done to stop it. There was a comparison made by some people, some of the people at Nova Scotia PIRG, so like QPIRG but in Nova Scotia, about how some people in the community of Sackville, who also had a landfill, and who were also complaining about loss of quality of life and loss of enjoyment of their homes and so on back in the 90s, they actually received a $5 million compensation and the landfill was closed down. This is a predominantly white community in the same province, not too far away. To quote one of the people working at NSPIRG, because I just thought it summed it up well, he says, "I look at how the concerns of the citizens of Lower Sackville were handled in the 1990s when it came to the landfill in their community, and how the citizens of Lincolnville are being treated, and I can only conclude that this is environmental racism. In the case of Sackville, the landfill was closed, a multi-million dollar leachate collection system was installed, and the residents and community compensated. In 2011, African Nova Scotians deserve better. They're still having meetings and nothing's been done so far." So I just want to illustrate that this is happening all over to communities of color and First Nations communities, not just in Canada, but all over the world in different ways.
That was three clips from a gender and environmental racism workshop held at the 2110 in February, facilitated by Maya, a member of Missing Justice. For more information on Justice for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, an autonomous working group of the 2110, you can check out missingjustice.ca. This is Dragon Root Radio, feminist-powered radio brought to you by CKUT and the 2110. In February, the Student Association for Medical Aid at McGill hosted a panel on women's public health. Why Women's Body Integrity Matters, hosted by Professor Rebecca Lewis, who talked about reproductive health in Canada and the States. Do stay tuned.
To get started, I want to kind of cover a few key definitions. So let's think about how we define reproductive health. So traditionally, This is reproductive health. In both the medical and public health field, reproductive health that focus almost exclusively on women of childbearing age. So in the epidemiological data, that's women from 15 to 44 years. And the goal of reproductive health was essentially helping women have healthy pregnancies so they could have healthy babies. And we see that in the mid-90s, based on the Cairo Conference, and you might be familiar with those reproductive development studies, the definition really broadened. So now we're looking at the current definition, which is the WHO, which tends to be the gold standard for public health, even though it is often a little aspirational. But you see that the things I really hope you notice here are first that this definition pulls reproductive health outside of just the realm of childbearing. So we start to see the idea of reproductive health and sexual health, reproductive health throughout the lifespan, and also implicitly something that includes men, as Laura mentioned, which usually left out of reproductive health. We also see, which is really important, is that it acknowledges that both decisions about fertility and sexuality are embedded in a larger social and political context. And I think this is true of any sort of health behavior, healthcare delivery, but particularly reproductive health issues tend to be highly politicized and very politically and legally regulated. So based on this definition, we have a list of topics that are generally considered part of sexual and reproductive health. So you know, family planning, contraception, maternal health, newborn health and breastfeeding, infertility. The list goes on. As I mentioned, I'm going to focus specifically on these two areas tonight, looking at focus on abortion and on family planning and contraception. But I think it's really essential whenever we talk about reproductive health in particular to really embed it in both a historical and global context. So I think it's surprising, and I think for all of us who are in this room in 2013 at McGill, we tend to think of abortion and contraception as a right, something that we kind of take for granted, we expect to be part of our health care. But actually, it's fairly recently, within 1969, contraception was legalized in Canada at the federal level. In the US, it was 1965, and abortion was actually illegal in Canada until 1988. It was 1973 in the U.S. So it's actually been a fairly recent historical event that we have access to safe abortion and to effective contraception. And I think we also need to remember, and we'll hear a lot more about maternal mortality a little bit later, but that it was essentially very much a public health drive, that the idea of making contraceptive access and abortion access legal was in part to combat high rates of maternal mortality that were caused by unsafe and illegal abortions in both Canada and the US. It's also important to consider group abortion globally, that we see actually that maternal mortality is the single greatest health disparity between high and low income countries. And unsafe abortion, maternal mortality and morbidity related to unsafe abortion represents a significant portion of that mortality. So I just really want you to understand there's a sort of causal link here between an unmet need for contraception, high rates of unintended pregnancies, high rates of abortion, and maternal morbidity mortality. So I think we need to think that abortion really, and contraception for that matter, are life and death issues and are really an essential part of larger health care. So let's talk for a moment about contraception. I want to take a moment to distinguish just between family planning and contraception. They're often used interchangeably, but family planning is really this broader idea that you can control the when you have children, the number of children, the spacing of those births. Contraception is the tool that you would use to reach your family planning goals. So to get started, I'm just going to ask you all, what is your ideal number of children? I know you're probably not there yet in your life, so listen to what I have to say about contraception, but in the future, how many kids do you want to have? No right answer.
Three.
Two.
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 Zero.
Zero. Four.
Four. Okay, well, this is perfect because most people said two, but we have a 0 to 4 range. Two is the middle. Yeah, so two. The average woman in Canada wants to have two kids. So that means that you have about 30 years of contraception right? You spend most of your life trying to not get pregnant. The goal of two kids, you have about 5 years where you're either trying to get pregnant or pregnant or immediately postpartum, and the rest of the time actively trying to avoid pregnancy. And I think it's important also to realize that contraception is...
Okay. You are listening to Dragon Root Radio. This is CKUT 90.3 FM. Be sure to tune in next Tuesday from 8:30 to 9 a.m. on CKUT for more feminist-powered radio brought to you by the Center for Gender Advocacy at Concordia and CKUT, or check out our archives at center2110.org. Be sure to check out the next Dragon Root workshop on understanding gendered violence at the 2110 Collective Campaign Building Against Gender-Based Street Harassment. Discussions about an ongoing campaign undertaken by South Asian Youth, SAY, a youth collective rooted in the South Asian Women's Community Center, also known as SOC, happened in early 2011. The campaign was initiated by young women living in Montreal, living in a Montreal neighborhood, to speak out and raise awareness about harassment in public spaces. This workshop aims to offer participants an opportunity to discuss strategies on campaign building and to offer insight into an ongoing anti-harassment campaign in the context of anti-racist and feminist politics. All workshops take place at 1500 de Maisonneuve West, Suite 404, and this is Wednesday, 6 to 8 p.m.